live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be exploring a lot on the environment today. We're going to look at a special report, The Water Crisis is Here, from Sherwood Ross of Op-Ed News. We have to really understand how serious it is, because a lot of people listening, I'm sure, are living in areas that, well, they may have some problem with water, no problem with water, or they may be in a severe problem with water. It's going to get a lot worse. I want to give you the news so at least you can know your likely moves in the future so you don't end up getting into a big jam. Also, we're going to talk about the Western diet. It increases the risk of death after prostate cancer diagnosis, Harvard University School of Public Health. Also, there's a University of Eastern Finland study showing those psychiatric drugs, they're called psychotropics, they increase your risk of suicide. And autism, well, it's big. There's about upwards of 2 million autistic children that we know of. A lot more may have autistic spectrum disorder, but at the lower end, so it hasn't been fully diagnosed. University of California, Davis. Autism cost estimated to reach upwards of $1 trillion a year. Wow. Where's that money going to come from? How are we going to pay for it? Well, I have a solution to that. Then we're going to examine the latest Board of Regents of the American College of Physicians. They support the elimination of all exemptions for immunization laws. Quote, allowing exemptions based upon non-medical reasons poses a risk both to the unvaccinated person and to the public, which means they're now going to be moving to mandate all Americans, all adults, to be vaccinated. Wow. How many vaccines are we talking about here? Well, there are currently over 340 in the pipeline, so imagine most of those will be mandated. What does that mean? It means if you're listening right now, in the very near future, based upon the outstanding lobbying of the American Legislative Exchange Council, your state legislators' willingness to accept money from them to serve their interest, all the while smiling, waving at you, kissing your baby, and saying, of course I'm for you. So at the federal level and at the state level, they'll do it at both levels, you will have to be vaccinated for every vaccine they deem important. How many is that? Well, it could be 300. But they're safe and effective, and you're not to question it. Well, that's interesting. So you mean everyone listening right now? Unless the doctor deemed that they had a medical reason not to, everyone would get all the vaccines, the vaccine makers, and their board of directors, and their lawyers, and their lobbyists, and their stockholders. Believe would be in their interest. Would that lead to problems? What do you think? And that's happening as we speak. Also, scientists discover a link between common medications and serious falls in older men, which is a big cause of death. Trinity College in Dublin. So we have a lot to talk about. My guest in the second part of our program, Dr. Richard Smith, is a historian specializing in China and its transition to capitalism. He is holds a doctorate in history from the University of California, UCLA. He's written many papers. He's the author of Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. So we're going to talk with him today about the dismal failures of green capitalism and the way it to transition to a new and truly sustainable economy. Also in this mix, if time permits, I'm going to do three things. One, the ways in which the economy never recovered that the media will not talk about. Two, the U.S. corruption versus world corruption. Clearly, there's a difference. If you're corrupt in India, Mexico, Russia, it's different than being corrupt in America, isn't it? Ian Welch will discuss. Also, an issue, and that's our talkback issue, where you'll have a chance to call in. And talking about climate change, from Dar Jamal, the new climate normal. I did an in-depth lecture last night on how the world that we are living in today is so different than the world we grew up in. And what would happen if there was a solar storm hitting the United States? Well, as I mentioned yesterday on this program, the government is already planning for that. Well, did they tell you about that giant city, the largest city in America, that no one's ever heard about? It's being built since mid-1940s, billions of dollars a year on it. Well, who gets to go to it? Where is it at? Why haven't we heard about it? So there are those who won't have to worry so much about a solar storm, and others will. And we'll tell you about that. It's just one of the problems that's the new norm. So we see there's a lot to talk about. Let's begin. From Harvard University School of Public Health. They have a study. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Prevention and Research that shows that after prostate cancer diagnosis, eating a diet high in red and processed meat, high in dairy foods and refined grains, well, that's just the normal, everyday Western diet, that can lead to, quote, a significantly higher risk of both prostate cancer-related death and overall death compared to eating a diet in vegetables and fruits and fish and whole grains and healthy oils. So there it is, quote, from the study, there's currently very little evidence to counsel men living with prostate cancer on how they can modify their lifestyle to improve survival. Our results suggest that a heart-healthy diet may benefit these men by specifically reducing their chances of dying of prostate cancer. That was from the professor of nutrition epidemiology at Harvard Chan School and the senior author. So in lay language, what they're saying is that if you eat the regular American diet, whoa, you have up to a, quote, 67% increased risk of death from any cause. Wow. Now, we're talking about millions of men in America have prostate cancer, and they're most likely to die, except if they shift over to a plant-based healthy diet. If you get rid of that which causes inflammation, trans fats, your saturated fats with the exception of coconut oil. If you start doing juices instead of colas, green tea instead of caffeinated coffee, start having lots of salads and tomato juice, having a healthy fruit like watermelon, peaches, pomegranate, nectarine, your berries, and good whole grains like brown rice, then you can not only not die sooner, but you can actually help improve, reverse, or prevent that prostate cancer in the first place. University of Eastern Finland, a major study there shows that, quote, analyzing the Finnish homicide and prescription drug databases discovered that the use of certain drugs that affect the central nervous system are associated with an increased risk of committing a homicide. The greatest risk was associated with use of painkillers and tranquilizers, while antidepressants were linked to slightly elevated risk. The study is the first one of its kind in the world. A Professor Tihonian research group analyzed the use of prescription drugs in nearly 1,000 people convicted of a homicide. And in recent years, there's been plenty of debate over whether psychotropic drugs can cause violent behavior. In particular, this debate has been fueled by massacres committed by young persons in schools and other public places in the United States and in Finland, too. Quote, it has been repeatedly claimed that it was the antidepressants used by the persons who committed these massacres that triggered their violent behavior. It is possible that the massive publicity around the subject has already affected drug prescription practices, end quote. Then it went on to take a look at this. So, here's the takeaway message. In the United States, you don't hear any of this. We associate homicides, especially mass homicides, with guns. We do not take a look at how many people who own guns never use them, have never committed any act of violence or crime. Instead, we focus upon the person, the gun, the violence, but never their state of mind, the psychiatric treatment they were under, the drugs they were taking. All of them have been on psychiatric meds. You would think that that would raise some attention, and indeed it would if we didn't have a major drug industry that has so much influence over the media that they spin out stories, propaganda, that keep it focused upon the guns only. Well, here's a country that didn't. They looked for the truth, and they found it. Look at the prescriptions a person's on because it can alter your behavior. That's the takeaway message. And also, autism costs are going to go up in the next 9 years, according to the University of California, Davis, from $500 billion to $1 trillion a year. Quote, U.S. California, Davis health economists have for the first time projected the total cost of caring for all people with autism spectrum disorder in the United States for the current calendar year. And then it goes on to project over the next 9 to 10 years. And what it's going to cost us is published in the Journal of Autism Development Disorders. And it's going to go to $1 trillion. So, who's going to pay for that? The parents can't. Why is it so expensive? Because it's a profitable field. Is it the drug that is so expensive? Yeah. Do these drugs actually reverse autism? Not one. Do they slow it down? Not one. What do? Well, they take the, let's say you have someone who's really experiencing what we would define as a psychotic experience. They're just emotionally in turmoil. There are antidepressants or antipsychotic medication that can take the highs and the lows off that person's behavior. And there may at some point be a need for those in some selective cases, but only as a temporary measure, and only to put that person or those around them out of risk of doing harm to themselves or others, which can and has happened. But now, here we have a kid that can't communicate, goes through repetitive processes. They might bang their head 1,000 times on a wall, or they may put something down and pick it up. Put it down, pick it up. This repetitive behavior is common in autism spectrum disorder. Now, they still hear what's going on around them. They just cannot either verbalize properly or act in a way that we would consider normal. So some of the medications will prevent some of the extreme episodes, but it doesn't do anything more than put the kid into a chemical lobotomized state. In effect, you're zombifying them. They're there. There once was a live person there, but today there is just this, almost this vegetable. So medicine thinks that's a good thing, and it's not. Now, today we have thousands of parents who have seen major improvements in their children. So much improvement, in some cases, the kids have reentered society as normal children. How do I know? Because I published a major paper on it. I did a multi-award-winning documentary, Autism Made in the USA, and I traveled and filmed people. And the last filming I did on this with a large group of parents was in Chicago. There were 400 parents who had come to meet. I had an opportunity to get many of the children in a room, and each one of the children was filmed telling us a little bit about themselves. And the most interesting one was a 16-year-old. And what was neat is, I guess they coordinated this amongst the parents, but they all the kids, from the littlest kid to the 16-year-old, they all had blazers on, and they looked really spiffy. It was really cute. And so here I'm talking with each of the kids, and they're having complete sentences, articulate, answering the question, no hyperactivity, no distraction. Then we come to the last kid. And he looks at me and he said, I just want to thank my parents for not giving up. Wow. I'm behind the camera and I'm thinking, that's a powerful statement. And I looked around the room, and as I looked around the room, many of the parents were standing behind us in this big ballroom. You could see they were wiping tears away. And he went on to talk about, he's an athlete, he's a straight-A student, he has a girlfriend, he's engaged in all the normal activity that before he started this protocol, I don't even know what protocol he was on. I didn't ask him whose protocol, but I think it was the Dan protocol. And that he couldn't have been where he's at today. So there are some wonderful parents who are doing all they can, not just trusting their Orthodox doctor, but looking outside. And it's outside the answers are. It's not within the Orthodox medical mindset or paradigm. So a few suggestions that can make a big difference would help save lives, improve the quality of some lives, and cost a whole lot less. First and foremost, show the honesty between the connection between vaccines and their various components, not just mercury, but aluminum as well, and damage to the mitochondria. Not just the mitochondria in the brain, but the mitochondria in the gut. Because almost always, you have a defective mitochondria energy production in the gut with the negative bacteria and also in the brain. Then show what would happen if you had 1,000 kids that didn't receive any vaccines and track them for 5 years, cross-matching them with 5 that got, 1,000 got all their vaccines, and then see the outcome. We've never done that. We could. Easy to do, inexpensive to do. But they won't do it because they're terrified of the outcome. Because what if this group of 1,000 kids that were not vaccinated didn't have any of the common illnesses, and those illnesses they did get, measles, mumps, chickenpox, they all survived? Well, then you're going to hold up as absolute, total mockery the idea that you must super protect every kid's immune system, and hence you do not want them to have any natural immunity. In fact, even telling parents, don't breastfeed, because if you breastfeed, it'll interfere with the effectiveness of the vaccines. That's how far we've come from a natural way of helping a child. Well, there are a group of children, more than 1,000, that have never been vaccinated and have none of the diseases, nor are they infecting people, and those are the Amish children. And the only cases of finding children in the Amish community who had autism were those who were adopted, were not naturally Amish, had been vaccinated prior to being adopted by the Amish, and were autistic before they came in. None within the autism, within the Amish community. So that's just one little piece of data, but we have an enormous amount showing the dangers of vaccines. Secondly, start realizing that the health of the mother and father directly determine the outcome of the health of the baby. And then breastfeed, and then give the baby healthy foods. No glucose water. No, none of the soy formulas. Those are genetically engineered. And keep them away from pesticides, herbicides, fungicides. Give them healthy, natural, whole foods when their body is able to develop a digestive system over 6 months to 9 months where they can handle some. and then see what happens. For those who already have autism, start looking at getting into the hands of holistic dietitians, nutritionists, nurses, physicians, who can guide you in detoxifying through natural chelation the heavy metals. Because by getting out the heavy metals, you frequently see an enormous improvement in speech and auditory capacity and motor skills. And then go in and rebuild the brain, rebuild the gut. It was 5 years ago in Washington, D.C., that I was asked to present a scientific paper. And I'm invited once or twice a year to large groups of scientists to present papers based upon studies I've done. And I introduced a young man who had been full-spectrum autism, so bad that even on 4 antidepressive, antipsychotic medications, it was not enough, and the psychiatrist suggested a 5th. Mother chose not to go that route, went a holistic route. I put him on protocol, and today Jonathan walks out on the stage, has little notes in his hand. I said, "What do you got there, Jonathan?" He said, "Outstanding student of the week." And I said, "And how many of those do you have?" He said, "Well, for the last, I think it was 10 weeks. And the audience says, "Look, these are all scientists and physicians. They're looking, what does this have to do with your paper?" In point of fact, I did nothing about my paper that day. I talked about what was possible. And I said, "What you're not aware of is that today, if he wasn't standing here talking about how he loves to make a breakfast, healthy breakfast, and play musical instruments and write, that he would be an institution for those suffering from autism who are too large or too violent." I said, "But he's here completely normal." "So you said it couldn't be done. You were right. And yet, here's someone that was autistic diagnosed and is not now." Well, when I finished, and I introduced a couple more people with other conditions, went out in the hallway, about 500 of these scientists came running out there wanting to know what they had just heard and seen. And I said, "I'm willing to invite anyone to my office. You can sit there when I counsel people. You can see what happens. You can look at all their records." And today, not one single physician, scientist, nurse, dietitian, nutritionist has come to my office to see how this happens. Not one. And by the way, Chicago, the same thing. Los Angeles, same thing. Las Vegas, the same thing. People may say that they want a treatment that works, but it has to be within the orthodox mindset and model. So we're never going to find anything but a $1 trillion bill and the pharmaceutical company making astronomical profits unless we get outside of that mindset. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with more. Please stay with us. Welcome you. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, sharing insights and information on a different group of topics. This is our talk back. That means I'll share these insights and then ask you to call in on our number, and I'll give you that call-in number in a moment. And you can give us your thoughts, your solutions. This is about corruption. And Americans are good at attacking American government officials are good at attacking other countries for being corrupt. And virtually every non-Western country is considered corrupt. Now, according to Ian Welch, there is no more corrupt country in the world than the United States. But maybe we're wrong on this. Let's pull back a moment. Let's put this to the acid test. For example, the bank bailouts. Was that pure corruption? Was there an entitlement given to the banks to protect them against the homeowners or small businesses that needed a break, needed a loan, low interest loan? Who got the loans? Did the banks perform even though a supermajority of the population was against them getting the bailout? But they had the lobbyist. They had one of theirs and Hank Paulson in the position of power as Treasury Secretary. Even though the banks had broken the law systematically, and even though the banks were bankrupt due to the decisions they knew were corrupt and illegal, and yes, stupid. The U.S. election system is flagrantly corrupt, with billions of dollars of direct and indirect donations from the rich. You buy candidates. You select them, and then you elect them. And they can charge any amount of money they want. If they're popular, they know that they'll make tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars as president when they get out of office. Who do they please? Who do they serve? You buy White House access with much larger donations, large enough, and you become an ambassador. Doesn't matter what your background or competence. Third-party PAC spending is in the hundreds of millions, now billions of dollars. The bribery of the U.S. is legal. Again, bribery is legal. That does not mean it is not bribery. That does not mean it is not corruption. This system was arranged by the moneyed classes to ensure that politicians owe them and do not harm them, and that they continue to pass laws and make actions which help them. The regulatory class is completely owned. There's a revolving door between Wall Street and the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, for example, and Wall Street pays far better. When senior officials leave, they get jobs from those whom they regulated or give speeches for six figures a lecture. Politicians are treated the same, receiving lobbying jobs worth seven figures, board positions. Now, mind you, this is all legal, but it is all corrupt. Wasn't it Jimmy Carter who just recently said, with respect to Citizens United, an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery? Well, he was right. But don't be deceived. Citizens United was just the final capstone. The U.S. was already a completely corrupt, bought and owned regulatory state before Citizens United. Citizens United just made it much easier. I repeat, in absolute terms, there is no more corrupt country in the world than the United States. In relative terms, who knows? But the U.S. being corrupt matters more than corruption in any other country. Why? Though China is coming on strong, U.S. financial law is essentially extraterrestrial. The U.S. is capable of crippling other countries' economies almost entirely with simple treasury orders. The U.S. has the world's largest military and regulatory regularly intervenes in other countries with airstrikes, assassinations, and general terror. What is unique about America is not its corruption, but countries are corrupt. It is the sheer hypocrisy, the pretense that America is not corrupt because Americans have made corruption legal. Corruption is the inevitable consequence of concentration of wealth and power. It always occurs when you have greater inequality, and it cannot be avoided. So what is your solution to our corruption? Legal corruption, bribery. The power rests with those who can afford to buy everyone else, who has a price tag. I'd like you to call in and give us your thoughts on this. And our number I'll give you in just a second. But I also want to share this as well. I believe that we do not look at the true cause or costs of official policies in Washington at the state level upon the average American. Here is where we have not improved in the recovery since 2008, in child poverty. How can you define improvement when we have more children living in poverty, in absolute poverty, and under $2 a day income for family member than ever before in our history? We have more poor kids today, homeless, than we did during the Great Depression. There are at least 2 million children living in abject poverty. Nearly a quarter of all, that's 22%, are classified as living below the poverty line. That's 18.7 million children, and that's rising. And the rate of black children living in poverty is 38%. So when we look at issues involving the African-American community, what suggestions, what implementations have been given to help them? How can you have a child raised in a poor family, in a poor neighborhood, without any support of getting out of there, and just denying that these people are relevant or essential to our future or our economy or our lives? Everything is interconnected. Denying that because of our hubris or selfishness or indifference is unfortunate. But think of what it is to be a poor black kid in the United States. What kind of future do you think awaits them? Then we have household income that is in decline. In fact, in the late 1960s, more than half of the households in the United States were squarely in the middle, earning at today's dollars $35,000 to $100,000. Few people noticed or cared as the size of that group began to fall. And now we have more people with, when you have adjusted income, they're actually making less today than they did back then. Though you have more millionaires today than ever before. And the problem is we start seeing these millionaires, of which there are between 8 to 10 million millionaires, and if each family has four people, that's 40 million people living in absolute wealth, then they're the ones buying the big houses, the boats, the cars, and the expensive restaurants. We forget about everyone behind them. Ownership. Well, when the subprime housing bubble burst years ago, a lot of people were caught underwater, and a lot of people saw, gee whiz, my entire investment, my home is gone. Well, today we have millions of homes that no one lives in. Why not rent them out at a reasonable price? No, Wall Street came in and hedge funds and bought them for pennies on the dollar, turned around and rented them out at high prices with poor service. So home ownership, especially among young kids getting out of college, is the lowest in over 60 years. And what about the backbone of American working class? It's small businesses. Less business is being started today, small businesses, than in the last 40 years because they have a hard time getting financing. And also, if you're a parent today and you want to start a business, are you also saddled with student debt? And how many of the new millennials can afford to be entrepreneurs, start their own business? They don't have savings. They've been living off credit cards. There have been no forgiveness of these usurious interest rates. So we have debt peonage. So why should we expect the average person getting out of college today to look forward to having a home or opening a small business if they're looking at the fact if they miss their payments, a SWAT team could break in their house and serve them papers, or they could go to debtors' prisons? And we have labor force participation smaller than ever before. There are over 60 million Americans that would like to work full-time, can't find it. So they take part-time work or they drop out of the workforce entirely. When they do, they're no longer counted as unemployed. What kind of economic alchemy is that? and we had the worst wealth inequality in the world. So the reality is we don't have normal as we did before. And yet we talk as if everything is good. It is not. Our number to call in for TalkBack is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Our TalkBack on corruption in the United States, where we say we're not corrupt, but the rest of the world is. Really? How do we correct it? What do we do about it? That's our question for you. Please call in. Back in a moment. Welcome all of you. Don't forget to go to our website where each day, every day of the week, 7 days a week, we publish 100 to 200 articles on progressive themes from around the world. Today, I put up several. I put up the saving of a little tiny dog that had its leg mangled and was laying in a sewer and was near death, and some citizens rescued it, took it to a shelter. And it showed a period of several weeks of the rehabilitation, this wonderful little creature, and then being adopted by this man and two larger female dogs, and how this little loving dog just loves these other two bigger dogs and plays and is completely healthy today, missing one leg, but she doesn't recognize it because she's out there running and swimming. I like to see things like that. First, to show those people who care about animals to protect them and rescue them, but also that sometimes when nothing seems like it's going right, something does. And also, I put up a film today about, it was a short little clip, about a minute and a half, of a man, a Muslim, going to get some fruit and vegetables. And he couldn't afford any of the package stuff. So the man who owned the little shop, when he started to walk away, he said, "No, come here." And he said, "Here, I've got something." He took a box of the ones that had been not selected, bruised, you know, not attractive looking, and he gave it to him. And the man wanted to give him some. He said, "No." So the man takes the box. Now, there's a man parked in front watching this, and he is more affluent, and he sees this, and you see him dialing on the phone. And then you see the man's home that got the fruit, and here's this little, very modest, bare-bones one room, and his children are sitting around. He washes the fruit, brings over, cuts it up, and then you see the kids eating it. This happens every day. And then the door rings. Here's the Good Samaritan, the man who was in the car. And he brings him in a refrigerator and food. It's important we see these things. Because for those who have somehow thought, and there are many, unfortunately, oh, these are all Arabs, they're all, you know, potential or real terrorists. No, these were just human beings going through some of the daily rituals that we all go through. And for those who are disadvantaged, you know, anything that you do that is a gesture of kindness is appreciated. And these were all Muslims. I want my audience to see this, that we are all human, irrespective of what biases people have. So I put up different photographs, articles, some hard-hitting, to remind us of love. And there's one up there today. I had never seen it before. There's this fellow that has a connection. He's an animal whisperer. He harmonizes with animals. Wonderful scene of him walking in the back, in the out bush. And suddenly two lionesses come at him. And they jump up and they grab him. They're taller. They're a foot taller than he is. And they just start kissing him. And then big lion comes and rolls over and he's scratching the mane of the lion. And these are not tame lions. These are wild creatures in a game preserve. And he walks with them. Hyenas. Hyenas have one of the strongest jaws in the animal kingdom. They're licking him in the face. And then the cheetahs, a whole group of cheetahs come over and just think he's a kitten. And you think, wow, there's a perfect example of harmonizing energies so they don't see him as a meal. Just something to remind us of the mysteries of life, of energy, and what we don't know. So go to GaryNall.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and get up to date on everything that's important around the world. And because we have listeners in every country in the world right now listening in, according to Google Analytics, I try to select articles that are relevant to everyone. Now let's go over to our phone. I want to get some of your thoughts. Let's go through these. If you could give us your short answer, please. Peter from Connecticut, your turn.
Yes, Gary, I'm a big fan. I love listening to you, and I appreciate your perspective. I just want to mention a couple of books that have been transformative for me and given me a lot of background. I'm sure you've heard of them. Confessions of an Economic Hitman by
Great
John Perkins. Are you there?
Give us one more. Yeah, give us one more title.
And then War is a Racket by Smedley Butler.
The best of the best.
Enlightening.
Most decorated soldier in history. People think it's Audie Murphy.
Right.
It was Smedley Butler. Right on. Thank you very much, Peter, for sharing that.
Thank you, Gary.
Give you an eye-opening about corruption. David from New Jersey. David, your turn.
Yeah, I think this would be difficult to do, being that the bar is corrupt, but I think we should try to prosecute all the lawyers who get things done for Wall Street and get things done for all the criminal companies overseas, the criminal U.S. companies overseas, and all the accountants that get things done for these people, all the illegal things that they do, they know that they do it. You somehow have to prosecute them to show them what can happen if they do it.
Good idea. I would suggest we did do a shortcut and try to have a national movement, a referendum on charters, because if you take away the charter of a corrupt corporation, then they can no longer practice business, and then they're vulnerable to personal prosecution. I appreciate your input, David. Thank you. One last quick one from Ray from Westchester. Ray, it's your turn.
Hey, how you doing, Gary? I would say a nonstop public shaming of themselves and their families, and I would take your idea of a general strike even further, where you don't buy, you don't sell, you pull your electric plug out of the wall. You don't get on the phone for as long as it takes for these people to step up and realize that we're here and we care.
I appreciate that input. Thank you very much, Ray. And for all the rest, I'll take them on another day with another talk back. Let's now go to Dr. Richard Smith, standing by. I gave you his background at the beginning of the program. Nice to have you with us today, Richard.
Hi, Gary.
Richard, I'd like to discuss with you some of the contradictions and inconsistencies regarding the ways our government is addressing climate change, and in particular with respect to the structural failures of market capitalism. Now, President Obama recently announced this plan to tackle the problems of global warming by reducing greenhouse emissions to more fanfare than it deserves. And of course, those of us who have been keeping a closer eye on the problems regarding his efforts are, well, his efforts are insubstantial and barely scratching the surface of the problem. It's just political showboating. And some might call Obama's agenda green capitalism. Now, you have a lot of criticism to level against those who believe we can tackle climate change and global warming from a pro-market, pro-growth model. So first, please begin with the fundamental errors behind the idea of green capitalism and the belief that constructive environmental policies can be accomplished within a free market capitalist economy in order to reduce greenhouse gases and reduce the pace of climate change and save our planet and ourselves. And then second, why is the concept of green capitalism actually further contributing to ecocide? The form is yours.
Thanks, Gary. I'd like to start with a quotation from Naomi Klein from her latest book. And she says, what the climate needs to avoid collapse is a contraction in humanity's use of resources. What our economic model demands to avoid economic collapse is unfettered growth. And I think she sets it up very well. That is the essential contradiction that we run up against time and again at every framework convention on climate change, every year, every December. For 24 consecutive years, those talks have ended up in dissension and acrimony because the leading polluters in the world will not accept binding limits on CO2 emissions because they understand very well that there's no green solution, that in order to suppress fossil fuel emissions, CO2 emissions by 90%, which the scientists tell us we have to do by 2050 or so, this is going to mean massive economic recession, collapse, a wholesale collapse of industries across the board, unemployment, unrest, and so forth. They understand that very well, and so that's why every year when the negotiations come up, they will not accept binding limits, and every year the talks collapse. In Paris, COP21 is already set up to fail because it's already on the table that no binding limits will be accepted. So today, or yesterday, in the New York Times, we have Obama's new climate plan, and I think that is a perfect example of the limitations that the corporate system, the corporate capitalist system, will not accept, will not go beyond, because Obama's, you know, he gets huge credit for all this, and you know he gets lots of applause for saying that he's going to cut fossil fuel emissions from. Greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. Well, power plants, he says, you have to run the numbers here. The power plants account for about a third of CO2 emissions in the U.S. And he wants to cut those by 32% in the next 15 years. Okay, fine. Well, that leaves 69% of emissions in the rest of the economy, in industry, in transportation, in agriculture, and so on and so forth. The bulk of emissions are really in those sectors, but he's not proposing to touch those. He's only proposing to beat up the coal-fired power plants a bit, you know, and force them to change to more gas and oil. So his intent is to reduce the emissions of those by 32%. Well, that would mean 32% times 31%, that would mean a net reduction of U.S. emissions by not much, by just under 10%, 9.9% over the next 15 years. Climate scientists, the IPCC, the EIEA, the World Bank, and other authorities have all told us that to prevent global temperature rise from exceeding 2 degrees Celsius, which is too high anyway, but even so, just to prevent that, we need to radically suppress emissions by 90% or more by 2050. Which means that the leading polluters like the U.S. and China would have to cut emissions on the order of 6 to 9% per year, not over 15 years, but per year. Meanwhile, the same Barack Obama, who gets all the credit for wanting to cut emissions in the energy sector, has been simultaneously promoting the most aggressive expansion of fossil fuel production in American history. In 2013, he bragged that we're drilling more oil and digging up more carbon than ever. We've added enough new oil and coal, oil and gas pipeline to encircle the earth. Yet it's ironic that as production has accelerated and the price of oil has plummeted over the last couple of years, that has only served to undermine his parallel initiative announced in 2013 to double U.S. fuel economy by 2030, because cheap fracked fuel has only encouraged the auto industry to produce the world's biggest gas hogs, larded with unnecessary, dangerous, distracting, energy-consuming electronic gadgets and, you know, heated, massaging seats and whatnot. The biggest selling cars, the Times reports this morning, in America are these huge obese SUVs and luxury trucks, the Ford F-Series and GM Silverados and Dodge Rams and so on and so forth. Cadillac's current Escalade gets worse gas mileage than its tailfin festooned El Dorado land yachts in the 1950s. What's more, even as the country is flooded with excess oil and gas, Obama is opening up the Atlantic seaboard to drilling and giving Shell Oil a go-ahead to drill in the Arctic. And he's not even launching. His so-called war on coal is much overrated. Not to worry, the coal industry says. Obama's no socialist. He's not suppressing coal production. He's just telling them producers to sell it to China or Germany or someplace like that. So taken together, far from a responsible plan to stop or even slow global warming, President Obama's economic policies and environmental initiatives can only accelerate global warming and drive us closer to the brink of collapse. He has in this no choice. He cannot subordinate the environment to the economic growth, or he'll face economic collapse and unemployment. Given capitalism, that's the point. Given capitalism, we face the problem of the ecology, the climate change, the ecological collapse will kill us tomorrow. But if we do anything to prevent that tomorrow by shutting down the industries that are polluting and causing all these emissions today, we'll face unemployment, mass unemployment, economic collapse today. So that means essentially that we're all locked into this cycle in which we have to work to produce, to sell more and more junk we don't need, iPads and iWatches and drones and whatnot, constantly searching for a new product, producing more and more junk we don't need, and in the process destroying our children's future to hang on to our jobs today. This is the central contradiction of capitalism.
I appreciate those insights. Richard, over the weekend, there were some reports that Germany's aggressive policies to transition to renewable energy had reached 78% success last month, meaning 78% of its energy needs came from renewable sources. Why should we be suspicious of how important Germany's efforts are, since Germany remains one of the largest driving forces of market capitalism? And if the U.S. were to adapt Germany's energy policy, how successful do you think it would be? And would it make a problem become a solution for our environmental issues?
Well, first of all, for Germany's accomplishment of 74% of its energy, that was in one day for a few hours when the weather was real good for one afternoon. A couple months ago, back in May. But the reality is that the Germans do claim that they produce close to 26% of their energy from renewable sources, and that's about 9% wind, about 3% water power, 7% biomass, 5% photovoltaic. But the rest, the bulk of Germany's energy still comes from coal. Lignite, 25%, hard coal, 18%, and nuclear energy still, in 2014, I'm reading the stats for 2014, still almost 16% from nuclear energy. So this is, they are still, and they increased the rate of coal production, imports last year because they were trying to shut down nuclear plants, which is a laudable thing to do. But the main issue is really not so much to me, the main issue is not so much where the energy comes from as what you do with the energy. Germany is the world's, I think, fifth largest economy, third and fourth largest exporter. More than 40% of Germany's exports are 40% of Germany's economy is exported. And the leading exporters, the leading export products of Germany are automobiles and machinery, especially automobiles. What you're talking about is using renewable electricity to produce global warmers, millions and millions of global warmers, of Mercedes-Benz, of Volkswagens, of Daimlers, Audis, and so forth. This is what the German economy is set up to do. They also produce trains and incredibly wasteful, incredibly expensive magnetic rubber trains for China. This is so crazy. These things are just so destructive of the environment to produce and run. They require just giant quantities of electricity. Anyway, so the point is to understand it doesn't matter so much what the electricity comes from as what you do with it. If you just use green energy to produce stuff that's not sustainable, goods and services that are not sustainable, then what difference does it make? What have you saved here? In the United States, we have an economy which is geared to producing, about 70% of the economy is geared to producing consumer goods, right? Now, of course, we all need food and clothes and shelter and transportation and so on and so forth, but just a huge proportion of the American economy is geared to producing consumer goods that, frankly, none of us really need. You know, it's just, a lot of it is just either the newest gadget, the newest must-have thing you have to have, or luxury housing, or luxury cars. I mean, the cars, I live in New York, and I look at these gigantic Suburbans and Cadillac Escalades and stuff out on the street here, just loaded up with leather and electronics and this and mood lighting, and oh my God, this is such an incredible, so unsustainable, such a waste to use valuable electricity to produce junk we don't need. Then there's the airplanes, and not to mention the defense industry, and then there's all the repetitive consumption designed to be obsoletized products that we consume every day. The plastic vacuum cleaners, the junky kitchen supplies, the disposable clothes. In an article I wrote on China, I talked about the rise of the essentially disposable clothes market, how it's dominated apparel, women's apparel today, such that clothes are now almost, they're so cheap that in many, and not just China, but Bangladesh and other places, but they're so cheap it's not worth the cost for women to bother to dry clean them. Just wear them two or three times, throw them away, and go buy another top for $4.95 or a skirt for $8 or something. You see the signs all over the place. So it's this kind of incredibly wasteful industry that we're using green electricity to power. So when people talk about the need to shift to renewable energy and green energy, I say, yes, that's fine. But what are we using it for if we're just wasting it on converting more and more of nature into product, cutting down the forest, mining the minerals, leaving the oceans? If we're just converting every possible resource we can get our hands on into ever new and ever more products as the world economy grows, and the products have a shorter and shorter life and less necessity, what kind of sustainability is this?
Richard, well said. For everyone, thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day.
Any day now.